Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host, researcher, minister, and friend, Charles Paisley, the founder of ChristianGospelChurch.org and the author of Come Out of Her, My People. Charles, it's good to be back. I was actually going to make a joke today. I don't have a purple shirt, but this is the closest thing I have to purple. It's like a maroonish thing, but I was going to wear my purple shirt, and I was going to say that, you know, the way they twist all of these prophecies, I too could fulfill the female president prophecy, because they can twist it to mean anything they want, you know?
Oh, goodness, John. You know, we're actually going to at least mention the man who had that very famous message dream today, John, about riding the trail again. So today, John, what I know we want to talk about is we want to start going into the post-William Branham history of the message. You know, in our last episodes we recorded on historical research, which was, I think it was about 18 months ago when we recorded that. It's been that long since we've been regularly recording. And we did a long message history series starting from really the birth of William Branham all the way up into his funeral. So we covered decades of message history as we did that. And today we want to start talking about the years that came after William Branham died. I have been working on, John, you know, a book, Volume 2 of Message History. Come Out of Her, My People, Volume 2. It'll hopefully be out and available by the time we get this episode out. I'm still working on some final tweaks to it to make everything happy for myself. But anyway, once it's out, it's covering the year 1966 to 2005. Those are the years that in it, John. And so I would love to just kind of dive through some of the stuff that's in there. Now, you and I, John, we actually lived through the majority of this period ourselves, didn't we? Right? So we are eyewitnesses to this era of message history, a lot of it. And I think that's really noteworthy that we're that. And John, you and I mean, just to be clear, so in case our listeners, maybe this is their first time listening, who are we, John? Well, we are from the original message churches. John, your grandfather, right, was the pastor of Branham Tabernacle in the years after William Branham died, the original message church. And I am formerly the associate pastor of Faith Assembly, which was the second message church. It was planted by the original early message community here in the Jeffersonville area. So we are lifelong members. I think I'm fourth generation message, actually, John. My grandparents and my great-grandparents converted into the message while William Branham was still alive. My parents were born, you know, during Tabernacle days, you know, back when William Branham was still living. And then I was first generation born after William Branham died. I think the same is true for you. Is that right? Like, how does your family line out in the message?
Yeah, my grandfather was the pastor at Branham Tabernacle in Jeffersonville, Indiana. And oddly, I still live in Jeffersonville. I live not far from the tabernacle itself. So as you can imagine, I'm public enemy number one in this town. But yeah, we grew up in the main sect, and it's kind of odd because we traveled all over the country. I went to 13 different schools growing up. My family went to several different message churches, and I went to even more than the ones they attended, because I would travel with friends and go to their churches. And then after I got married, we visited other churches still. So I visited a lot of message churches. And the irony is, I had friends growing up, and I was one of the fortunate ones. I was allowed to go to public school, so I had friends in public school. And I never will forget, we moved to this town where I thought we were the only Branhamites within miles and miles. Like, there was a church in another state. You had to cross the state lines, and I think it was like 30, 40 minutes away, which for me in this little small town, that was a great distance. Now that I live here in the Louisville metro area, it's nothing. But back then, it seemed like miles away, you know. But I'm attending this school. There's not a single Branhamite in the high school that I'm in. And suddenly, this guy, this friend of mine, I've known him probably 3 years, 4 years at this point. He comes up and starts to witness to me about quote unquote Jesus. And I did not know what the word cult meant or the implications of that. But I could tell something was really off with this guy. And he was going on and on and on about his church, which wasn't a Message or Branham-connected church. Then all of a sudden, the guy mentions William Branham. And my ears light up. I'm like, wait, how do you know? And he starts telling me who Branham is and how, you know, this great prophet and how he set the stage. And then suddenly there's his church. And I was shocked. I didn't know what to say. And I tried to witness back to him, but I was just so shocked it really didn't work. So I knew at that time that Branham had an impact. I knew that. I was probably age 18 at that point. I also, my family would, we were largely a tape home church. We would listen to William Branham's tapes in our living room two times on Sunday, Wednesday evening. We'd all dress up in our Sunday go-to-meeting clothes and sit in our living room, and we weren't allowed to speak. We weren't allowed to raise our hands, make any noise, anything. Like, literally sitting there like zombies listening to these recordings of this old dead guy. And I'm listening to these things, and the reason why we were a tape home church is because my family would go to try out a different church in whatever city and state that we lived in. And they would come, as we're driving back, they would just rail the minister and the church and the people and just, you know, very derogatory things, which were accurate. Like, I agreed with most of them. And what I didn't realize is what they were describing, the things that they had problems with, was that they were describing it was a destructive cult. But they didn't use the word cult. I don't think they really knew the implications of that. But we're literally leaving Message cult churches that were splinter groups from the main sect that we tried out. And my family realized that this is a cult. So that's how bad it is. In the main sect, we could tell that the splinter groups were cultish. What we couldn't realize in the main sect is that the main sect was cultish. And so that's largely why I am so interested to dig deeper. I released my book, Weaponized Religion from Christian Identity to the NAR, which it's funny because I'm doing the same thing you did with your second book, but in a different direction. So I'm looking at the things after Branham. And everybody's been asking, when is the audiobook coming out? And hopefully by the time this podcast is released, I just hit submit yesterday on publishing the audiobook. I had a voice condition, and it literally put it on hold for months. So it's been on hold, but I did submit. Hopefully when this book is released, you can listen to Weaponized Religion from Christian Identity to the NAR. But yeah, that's my backstory. We were in a cult. We visited cult churches, and everything that we're going to talk about in this series is interesting to me because it explains why these churches were such a mess that we attended.
Right. And you know what you described there, how each in the main sect you could recognize that the other sects were cult. Well, in our sect we recognize that your church was a cult, John. You know, it's that way. Every group, every part of the message thinks every other part is the bad part and they're the good part. That's just how it is. So we called, in my group, for example, John, we called all the rest of the message Branhamites, but we were the message. We were the wow. message and everyone else was Branhamites, right? That's how we termed it. And a lot of the groups, they have that sort of terminology. So yeah, it really is amazing. But here's the thing. There's not a lot of people that have a real good understanding, it seems like, of what happened in 1966, 67, 68, up into the early 70s. And so I do think it's important for us to kind of talk through all that and how the message broke down. And a couple of the reasons that people don't know a lot about that era of message history, John, is because, one, that era is full of massive embarrassments to the message community that everyone wishes they could forget, right? No one wants to talk about it all, right? So that's number one, okay? And then number two is, and this is something that they purposefully hide, is the message community was not all that big back then. It was actually pretty small. The message community after William Branham was not all that big. And most all the people who became shakers and movers, like, you know, the Ed Biscoles of the world, the Perry Greens of the world, they were actually nobodies in the message, more or less, when William Branham died. They were nobodies, right? And they had very little real connection to William Branham or the central parts of the message. And so they themselves don't even know the history because they weren't there, right? And so that is another important aspect. And so again, that's why people like me and you, John, we can actually fill in the blanks in a way that they can't, because not only were they not there, no one in their churches were. They were not even in the message back then, right?
Yeah.
Like you take Ed Biskel. I mean, he didn't accept, for example, William Branham's Elijah claims until right at the very end of his life. He didn't have a message church when William Branham died, right? He just wasn't really someone we would call in the message at that point. Or you take Perry Green. Perry Green accepted the message, according to his own testimony, in middle of 1964. A year and a half before William Branham died, Perry Green joined the message, right? And so you have decades of history where there were all kinds of people, especially here in the Jeffersonville area, that were close to William Branham in his inner circle. This thing had developed a long time before those sort of people showed up. Like Perry Green's church was open, what, I think the month before William Branham died, right?
I think so, yeah.
The message community was not all that big when William Branham died. And so I look forward, we'll take a few minutes and chat through that.
Yeah, it'll be good. And so our audience has expanded significantly since you and I did that initial run of podcasts. We have people from... We have a large number of people that are coming out of the International House of Prayer because it was basically Branhamism 2.0, created by and large through Paul Kane, who was William Branham's protege. And I talked to Kane a few times on the telephone, and the things he told me, maybe I can mention some of them in this podcast. I still can't mention them all, but for the people who have never heard of Branhamism and have never heard the names that we've mentioned, Perry Green, Ed Biskel, for example, we're going to be going through what that is on this podcast. These are, I call them the pillar churches. Whenever William Branham died, the whole cult was imploding. And if not for these pillars lifting him back up, lifting up the dead guy to worship, it just would have imploded and you would never have heard the name Branham again. I think by and large, the charismatic movement was trying to distance themselves from Branham, but because of these pillar churches, they were quite unable to do so because his name just kept going and going. And as long as his name was going, they couldn't stop it.
I know. And one of the worst things about it, John, worse from some, probably the charismatics perspectives, is they wanted to try and rehabilitate William Branham somewhat, you know, keep the baby, right, and throw out the bathwater, you know, is what they wanted to do. But the problem was, John, there was a massive cult that was worshiping William Branham. And try as they might, they could never, I mean, you couldn't hide the cult, okay?
Yeah.
The cult was here, it wasn't going away, and they were going to fight tooth and nail over all of this stuff, right? And you were never going to convince the cult that William Branham was not a cult leader, right? Obviously.
No. And the water wasn't quite bathwater.
No. William Branham was the Elijah to these guys. And I want to throw that out, too, because maybe some people wonder how I use my terminology and stuff. To me, when I wrote my book, John, and when I think about what is a message church is a church that has a pastor who at least believes William Branham was Elijah. Okay, if you don't have a pastor who didn't believe William Branham was Elijah, you're not a message church. You're a Latter Rain church. That is really where you cross the line from a Latter Rain church to a message church. A message church is basically a Latter Rain church where the preacher started to believe William Branham was Elijah, and then a whole bunch of other stuff followed after that. But that to me is the transition point. The church's pastor started to believe he was Elijah. When William Branham died, there were an upper limit of 5,000 people in the message. 5,000 people, the upper limit, that believed he was Elijah. Now, yeah, he preached to tens of thousands of people, but the upper limit was 5,000 who believed he was Elijah. I personally think it was smaller than that, John, too. And I get that 5,000 number by the attendance at his funeral service. There were 5,000 signatures in the guest book at his funeral. And obviously he attracted all kinds of people who weren't part of the message to that funeral as well. But you and I both know, John, the old timers, everybody who was anybody in the message came to that funeral. And so that, I think, is the most accurate number we can get to the potential size of the message community when he died. 5,000 is the upper limit. And there were approximately 35 message churches that had pastors who believed William Branham was an Elijah figure when he died. And so let's just kind of start to walk through those. And again, before I do, I keep saying before I do, but I'm not getting to the meat, am I, John? I don't like a whole lot talking about living people, and I try to avoid that. And for the most part, most all of these people are all dead, but there are a few here and there. I think there's maybe two that are still living today of the you know, original, I'd say, lieutenants of William Branham. All the rest of them have passed away. Most all the people that we would talk about that were significant figures, even up until 2005, are mostly all passed away by now too. But there are a few living ones in here, and there, you know, there might be some pieces we just omit to be nice to people, but and then we'll talk about it after they're dead. But but if they don't change their ways, right?
Yeah.
So anyways, when William Branham died, this Jeffersonville was message central, right? This was the heart of it. This is where the message had arose, and the overwhelming majority of the message community actually lived in Jeffersonville up until he moved to Arizona in 1963. I think before he moved in 63, John, there were about 1,000 message believers here in Jeffersonville. The message had planted 5 churches here in this area, and this was the hotbed of it. And so the 5 churches in this area, and I think this is probably worth noting too, John, all the churches we're going to talk about today and all the preachers we're going to talk about today, between the two of us, John, we have probably been to just about every single one of these churches and know every single one of their pastors. Okay, so the churches here in Jeffersonville, of course, you had the Branham Tabernacle. Well, when William Branham died, that church was still pastored by Orman Neville. Okay, and Orman Neville, we're going to talk about what all happened at the Tabernacle and how it led up to your grandfather taking over. But Orman Neville was the pastor after William Branham died. Notably, though, the church board was controlled by the Deity cult, and the deacons were in the Deity cult. Okay, so but Orman Neville was not. Orman Neville was someone, John, who aligned with the anti-church order faction of Message, the anti-tape church faction. Okay, so the Branham Tabernacle set up for a fight. Okay. You move up the street, you go over to Clarksville, Indiana. That's where you'd find the church I'm from, John, Faith Assembly Church, which was the second message church. It was pastored by Raymond Jackson. It's moved locations several times. It was in Clarksville then. It's on the edge of Jeffersonville now. But that was the second message church, Raymond Jackson's church. It was smaller. It had, it might have had about 100 people, roughly 75 to 100 people when William Branham died. Then you move over to Full Gospel Tabernacle, which was also in Jeffersonville. That was Don Ruddle's church. That was a medium-sized church, another one, maybe 75 people. They were also in the anti-church order faction. Okay, you go a little further up the street, you get to Sellersburg. You got a Full Gospel church there called, I think it's called Gospel Tabernacle of Sellersburg. Its pastor was Gerald Metcalf. It was also another one of the very original message churches. It was pretty small back then. I think it might have had 25 people when William Branham died. And so those are the churches right here in the hub at Jeffersonville. And then you go up into Bloomington, Indiana. There was Full Gospel Church of Bloomington. It was pastored by Willard Crace. It was also one of the very first message churches. And so that was kind of the local Southern Indiana Jeffersonville message community. You'll find William Branham talking about all those guys on tape. John, between the two of us, we know them all. We've been to them all. You know, we know all that pretty well. So
I want to go back and focus on something that you said, because I think it is significant as it relates to where we're headed. You said that to be a message church, it was defined as people who believed William Branham was Elijah the prophet. And if you studied any of the history that I've published, this was a recurring theme in Pentecostalism. It wasn't limited to Branham's cult of personality. You had Charles Fox Parham, who claimed to be the Elijah successor to John Alexander Dowie. Dowie claimed to be the Elijah for his age. You also had Frank Sanford, who was a contemporary to this. And all of this is the British Israel framework. It was transitioning into Christian identity around the time that Parham started claiming that he was the next Elijah successor. But this was a recurring theme. I will further define what you said by saying it is a group of people who believed that their prophet was the messenger for the age. So in the message, they believe that William Branham was the return of Elijah the prophet, and that the prophet was the messenger for the age. And this was not limited to the people who are off on the side in this message, cult of personality. T.L. Osborne, who is a Word of Faith, Prosperity Gospel guy, was in Branham's deity cult and proclaimed himself as such at William Branham's memorial service. So this was widespread through charismatics as they were starting to form and grow and develop into other things that became NAR. But when Branham died, what the charismatics tried to do was shift to the new messenger for the age. And if you listen closely to what T.L. Osborne is saying, he is defining himself as believing Branham was the voice of the age or whatever, so that he could then start believing in the new voice for the age. It's very clear what happened. And right after this, months after this, the shepherding movement was formed. You had Ern Baxter, and who was part of the Baxter Branham campaigns, and they created this framework of authoritarian control called the shepherding movement. Osborne helped establish that. He was supplying training materials for them. So this is widespread. Where that gets significant, and I do go through this to a limited extent in the book, Bob Jones and Paul Kane, they were setting up Branhamism 2.0, and if you listen closely to what Bob Jones said to Mike Bickle, and then what Paul Kane was reaffirming, they were trying to set up Mike Bickle to be the next messenger for the age. So in Branhamism 2.0, we don't yet know what, like Branham was Elijah, we don't know what, you know, it would have come out to be, what biblical figure they would have chosen. I think there were a few names thrown out, but essentially they were setting up Mike Bickle to be the new prophet for the age in Branhamism 2.0. And that's just one of many, many groups that were doing the same thing and have done the same thing since William Branham died.
Exactly. You know, William Branham was the authority figure of doctrinal everything, you know, in this movement. He was pope-like in a lot of ways. And the Elijah stuff started, you know, he started claiming and insinuating the Elijah stuff in 1949, and 1952 and 53 is really, in my view, when the Branham cult of personality, such as we know it today, started to form. You don't find anybody who believed William Branham was Elijah before 1952. Like, that's the earliest date that I know anybody of these people, any of them, none of them claim to have believed it before 1952. But from 1952, you start getting people believing he's Elijah. And then by 1955, you start to have churches pastored by people who think he's Elijah. And then it's when you get to, I believe, 1961, that's when he starts to introduce the idea that he's a Seventh Church Age messenger on top of being Elijah. So, you know, he's his list of credentials is getting longer, John, as he goes through life. And, you know, of course, at the very end of the deity cult, you know, he adds God to the list of titles. So it gets pretty long there by the end. But so here in the Jeffersonville area, and you mentioned, John, T.L. Osborne, Paul Kane, Joseph Matson-Bose, Gordon Lindsay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they were all coming through all these churches in those years, right? The churches I mentioned, well, they were at them churches. Paul Kane's been to all those churches, right? He was there coming through all this stuff back then. So when we talk about this, we're not just – this is the history of the whole thing, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it all passes through here. So we'll definitely talk about a lot of that in detail, you know, as we hopefully get to break some of this stuff down. So those are the message churches. And I think it's important to note too, John, that most of the churches – were at least informally part of the Independent Assemblies of God back then. For the most part, they were. The early message churches were mostly informally part of Independent Assemblies of God. That's where a lot of the preachers were ordained out of, or their actual ordination papers came from. And if you remember, Independent Assemblies of God was the main trunk of the Latter Rain movement, right? When Sharon Orphanage split up, the Houghton brothers... Well, Sharon Orphanage was in Independent Assemblies of God when it broke up itself. And so the Houghton brothers, who had started the revival, they stayed in Independent Assemblies of God, and they continued to fellowship and really be what I would call message churches themselves up until they died. So anyways, that's the message community in Indiana. So if we kind of go up over to the East Coast and come down, In New York City, we had two message churches. We had the Church of Anthony Milano, and his head deacon was Pat Tyler. They were mobsters. They were in the New York mob. That was their church. Then you had Joseph Coleman and Orlando Hunt. They had another church in New York City. And their two churches eventually merged, and Anthony Milano moved to Arizona, which, again, if you know mob history, John, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean, because that's where all the mobsters moved at the same time, you know? What?
Yeah.
So, anyways, you got Anthony Milano, you got Joseph Coleman's churches up there in New York City. Those were also there, and their churches were fairly recent churches. Coleman opened his church in, I believe, December 1963, and Anthony Milano's church was a pre-existing church. It was an Independent Assemblies of God church that converted to the message, a pre-existing church. In their church, there was another minister that was pretty important. His name was Robert Lambert. He's from Connecticut, and all these people are passed away, but Robert Lambert fellowship mostly in Milano and Coleman's church there at the first. And after William Branham died, he actually was one of the primary missionaries that planted the message churches in the Caribbean after William Branham died. But he was there in those churches at the point that William Branham died. Then as you kind of come down into Appalachia, you've got several churches. And I'll point out the the Coleman church and the Milano church were of the groups that would eventually form the Thunders. So, and they were just kind of a different breed of church. We'll do some whole episodes on them, I think. But as you come down into Appalachia, you've got the church, you got in Chambersburg, Virginia, you have the church of Ernest Fulcher. In Kings Mountain, you have a church of Bill Pederis. And then over in Edmundston, Kentucky, you have the church of J.T. Parnell. And you'll find all these people mentioned a lot. These were the only real churches in Appalachia that were message churches when William Branham died, and all of the other churches in that region are either splits or branches out of their churches. I would say probably Bill Pederis' church was the largest, John, and he had about 50 to 75 people in his church when William Branham died. Basically, that seeded the entire message community that grew up in Appalachia after William Branham died. You know, Virginia, that area. So Ernest Fulcher's church and Bill Pederis' church were in the anti-church order faction, John. So it's probably, you've probably never heard of them, right? But you probably have heard of J.T. Parnell's, right? He was more aligned with the main sect. And I think it's also worth pointing out, J.T. Parnell was one of the original message polygamists. His was a polygamy church, John. So we'll talk through all that. And then as you go further down south, you had in Macon, Georgia, you had a church you're probably familiar with there, John. Maybe you mentioned that one a little bit.
You had a few down there. I spent a large portion of my childhood in the Macon area, so I'm very familiar with all of the groups there. And you had Jack Palmer, who was there when William Branham died. And another thing I want to mention that a lot of people, I don't think, realize, you mentioned that by and large, this was the Independent Assemblies of God that were still connected to Branhamism. Well, if you remember, towards the 1960s, when Branham's mentor, Roy Davis, the Imperial Wizard of the Klan, when he was rising up to become Imperial Wizard, he was connecting back with the main sect of the Assemblies of God. So you'll find articles down in Texas where he, at this point, he is with Latter Rain. He's been published in, you know, the Voice of Healing magazine as this Latter Rain revivalist. I don't think they use the word Latter Rain, but that's what it was. And he's, at that time, he's one of the public debaters for the Assemblies of God. You can find newspapers stating this, which was a little surprising to me. I knew it beforehand, however, because my family took our first cruise on the ocean. We went from Florida down to, I don't know, one of the little Disney islands, whatever it was. I'm on this cruise thinking that I had escaped everything message to be, you know, this is only a few years ago we took our first cruise. I thought we had escaped all things message and I was going to take a little break. And lo and behold, I'm up there wearing my nice shorts out on the sun on the deck and upper deck. And here comes this woman in a long, thick, hot jean skirt and long flowing. She's dressed just like a message lady, right? And I was so curious. I kept going to try to not really eavesdrop, but just try to meet him, say hi, that kind of thing. And I'm walking up as they're talking, and man, they weren't a message cult. They were Assemblies of God, but they were from Indianapolis. And that sparked my curiosity. So I started investigating the main sect of Assemblies in the Indiana area, in the Kentucky area, and probably parts of Ohio. By and large, the main sect of the Assemblies of God was, I'm not going to say they were Branhamites or they were message, but they were strongly tied and affiliated to Branham, in so much that I have had people who escaped the Assemblies of God, the main sect, recently, who said that their Assemblies of God churches actually had Branham tapes and sometimes would play them in the church. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I think it's important, too, to distinguish independent Assemblies of God from Assemblies of God, too, because who are independent Assemblies of God? Primarily, they are the churches that Assemblies of God threw out over the Latter Rain stuff. That's primarily who they are. And so the main body in the, you know, as you come through the purge into the late 50s, they gradually ran out of their own group or they exited voluntarily. And it's mostly Latter Rain churches that the main body of Assemblies of God pushed out. Some of them were hostile takeovers, too, I'll say. Like, some of the, they actually, we'll talk about some hostile church takeovers and all this, too, John, but there's tricks to go in and hostile take over a church and seize their assets and seize their property and stuff using their, kind of, some tricks in the governance structures. And that's how some of these churches actually got a hold of property and stuff from the pre-existing churches. So, yeah, you had Jack Palmer in Macon, Georgia. That was really the only message church in Georgia at the time William Branham died. And again, all of the other churches grew up in the few years after he died were plants and splits out of these earlier churches. Jack Palmer had his church. He aligned with the Tape Church faction in later years. He was pro-church order faction. He was on that side of the early message split, which we're going to talk through. You get down to Florida. In West Palm Beach, Florida was a church that had been pastored by Lee Vail and Ned Iverson. Vail actually left the church at that time. He was in Ohio at the time that William Branham died. But I believe, and this is, I'm not 100% sure on this, I think Ned Iverson was still pastoring that church in West Palm Beach, Florida. And here's a funny story too, John. So West Palm Beach, Florida is just about the most southerly point in the United States. You can't get much further south than that in the United States, right? Well, when Lee Vail was pastor there, he prophesied a prophet from the north was going to come and speak to them, and he would be what they need. You want to talk about a safe prophecy, right? And William Branham showed up, okay?
Was he to be wearing purple?
So, you know, it's pretty funny stuff, isn't it? I guess unless they swam out of the ocean, right? They wouldn't have been coming from the south pretty well. So, yeah, pretty well anybody who came from the north was going to fulfill his prophecy. But anyways, he used that as a great sign. He talked about that a lot in his ministry, about how he predicted William Branham was going to come and be this great prophet, the prophet from the north, from Palm Beach, Florida.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So you had his church down there. Then you kind of come over into the south. In Louisiana, there's actually no message churches in Louisiana when William Branham died. There's some there today. Jack Moore's church, Jack Moore did not believe William Branham was Elijah. There's lots of churches like that, that they were Latter-rain churches. They liked William Branham. They invited him around. He preached a lot. But they did not believe he was the Elijah, right? And they never evolved into message churches. There's the same thing here in Jeffersonville, right? Like, you know, there's a church out in Utica, for example, that fellowshiped with William Branham. But they never accepted him as Elijah, right? And so they never really, they split from the message and more or less stayed Latter-rain oriented. But if you move up into Arkansas, there was a church in Waddell, Arkansas, which was pastored by Earl Martin and his brother John. They were there when William Branham died. They were of the church pro-church order faction. They were, you know, became a tape church. They were kind of deity-minded people as well. And moving up from there into Thayer, Missouri, you had a church of Paul Brewer. Paul Brewer was another very important minister. His church wasn't very big. I think he might have had 50 people at the most in his church. You actually interviewed someone from his church not long ago on the podcast. It was a really good interview.
Yeah, I did.
But he was one of the original message pastors. He was actually served as trustee at Voice of God Recordings in later years. He was a pretty important figure. And he was there in Thayer, Missouri. And as far as I know, I think he was the only real message church in Missouri, even when William Branham died. And then you keep going on up. Around Chicago, there were a lot of people who believed the message in the Chicago area, but there wasn't a message church in the Chicago area when William Branham died. They were all part of what you'd call Latter-rain churches, but some churches did pop up there shortly after he died. Then in Michigan, you have in Ann Arbor, there was the church of Samuel Johnson. We'll probably talk a little bit about him. Samuel Johnson was a child molester. He ended up in prison. But that was a notable hub of message missionary outreach in the early days. Like their church, along with some of our others, helped sponsor the original missionaries of the message into the Philippines, the Dominican Republic, different places. So we'll kind of talk through that. But he was an important, I'd say, mission center of the message. And so that, I think, John, I mean, let me just think through my head. I think that is most of the churches. There was an Ohio Lee Vales church, but that was most of the churches in the eastern United States at that point that believed the message. Lee Vale, his church was, I'm not 100% sure exactly when he started his church in Ohio. It's in St. Paris, Ohio. It's called Grace Gospel Church. But I'm not sure if he started that before William Branham died or just after. But he was definitely in Ohio, and it would have been the only real message church in Ohio at that time. There was another very important message church that opened shortly after William Branham died. It was Lonnie Jenkins Church up there. I'm sure we'll talk through a little bit about that. But Lonnie Jenkins was a full gospel businessman, and some wealthy people helped sponsor him opening a message church shortly after William Branham died in Lima, Ohio. So that is the churches of the eastern half of the United States. In the western United States, John, there was even less. Now, we know William Branham moved at the end of 1962 is when he moved, and he was there all of 1963. When he moved, so there were about 1,000 people in Jeffersonville, 500 of them packed up and moved with him, okay? And not only that, but he sent out calls to other churches. There was a message church in San Jose back then, Doug McHugh's church. William Branham told Doug McHugh's to basically sell everything he had and move to Arizona. So Doug McHugh's moved to Arizona. Doug McHugh's, he was tape church, deity, that side of things. As were, frankly, most of the people who moved to Arizona back then. I don't think Lee Vale knew what he, or rather Perry Green realized what he was getting into when he moved. Like he he was not a great guy, but he was probably the most sane one in the whole bunch. And that's saying something, you know what I mean? So he moved out. So all these people are moving out to Arizona. In Arizona, you got two message churches when William Branham dies. You have the one-month-old Tucson Tabernacle, and you have the year-and-a-half-old message compound of Leo Mercer in Prescott. Those were the only two message groups, really, in Arizona when William Branham died. we'll talk a lot about that. But William Branham basically brought a whole bunch of people and preachers with him to Tucson, and he lured a lot of them with the promises that they're going to get to start the church in Tucson. He promised Doug McHughes he would get to start the church in Tucson. He promised Perry Green he would get to start the church in Tucson. All right, all these people are coming out there, and guess what? Only one of them is going to get to be in charge, and so they all start fighting and squabbling, and we'll talk about all that. But yeah, it was a, you know, the early message community was really crazy, and the way that kind of broke down, and that geographical divide between Arizona and Jeffersonville, that set the stage for some of the divisions to come too, because it was primarily Branham almost extracted most of the Deity people from Jeffersonville, moved them to the desert with him in Arizona, and left his more Elijah-minded people here in Jeffersonville. The Deity people ended up coming back. We can talk through some of that later, but that's what was happening there, you know, through that move, I believe. And then, let's see, going up, there wasn't any message churches in Texas, really, when William Branham died. I mean, Perry Green Sr. lived in Texas, but he was more in a latter rain-minded churches. Jack Bell started his church after William Branham died. And it was probably the most prominent message church in Texas, I would say, in the years to come, would be Jack Bell's church, most notable one. Then there's not much in the, you know, across the, really the rest of the Midwest or the West. If you go into Oregon, there was a church in Oregon, John. It was Orlando Walker's. He's the man who had, I believe, the, you know, we'll ride this trail again vision, right? So yeah. That's Orlando Walker. Orlando Walker's son was Gerald Lee Walker, okay, who was Sarah Branham's lawyer when they sued all the message people. Their church ended up going with Kenneth Hagin into the Word of Faith movement in the 1980s. And yeah, Kenneth Hagin was coming around to all our churches too. I know they all like to pretend none of this stuff happened. But Kenneth Hagin, he ended up siding with Kenneth Hagin when some of those splits happened in the 80s. But we'll talk through that later. But his son, Gerald Lee Walker, was a trustee of the Full Gospel Businessmen's Institute, the whole fellowship, the International Fellowship. He was a really notable person, his son. And Orlando Walker was involved with the Full Gospel Business people quite a bit himself. And they were an important message church in Oregon. South of that, in Ukiah, California, was another old message church. It was the, I believe it's called Gospel Tabernacle. It was founded by Gordon Engman. And it was started in 1957 after William Branham held meetings there. And you and I have talked about that one a fair bit. So that church yeah. that was planted in Ukiah in 1957 by William Branham, well, who was along at that revival when that was planted?
Jim Jones.
Jim Jones was there, you know, through all of that stuff. And when Jim Jones, if anyone knows Temple Message, People's Temple history, when they all left Indiana, where did they move? Ukiah, okay? But he had already been in Ukiah with William Branham. They planted that church out there. So it's not even a coincidence, I don't think, that Jim Jones decided to move his congregation to Ukiah. There was a pre-existing message community there. He had been there with William Branham personally. So that's all some interesting facts and connections. But that was it, John. I think, let me think, am I missing anybody? I don't think I'm missing. I believe that is all of the major churches in the United States that believe the message when William Branham died, right there. Which isn't that big, really.
It's such a weird mess, man, because you had William Branham dying. You had Latter Rain dying with him. You know, Latter Rain truly can't carry on. I know that the Latter Rain revival split off, and they kind of weren't Branhamites, and it developed into its own thing. But the original Latter Rain, as it was whenever it merged with Voice of Healing, that mess just continued on into disarray. And something you said, I'm not going to go too deep with this because for obvious reasons, but you mentioned out on the East Coast, you had the mob tied into the message. And I never will forget, and I'm not going to go too far with this story. I know everybody wants me to, I'm not. But Pat Tyler, my grandfather knew Pat Tyler. And Pat Tyler, my grandfather would tell the story all the time. He was an ex-mafia hitman, and Pat Tyler would walk up to him in a suit coat and just playing around. He apparently had a sense of humor. He would ask people, such as my grandfather, all right, stand there and pretend like you're drawing a gun. And by the time your arm was about, I don't know, a fourth of the way up, Grandpa said he had reached in his coat pocket, pulled out his actual pistol and pointed it at you. By the time your hand was up halfway and was pointing at you, he had holstered the gun again and was pointing his finger at you. So he was that fast of a draw. And I remember the stories growing up. I started down the research of publishing the mafia affiliations, which everybody wants me to continue. Once I started it, the internet kind of went ablaze. Because when William Branham moved to Tucson, all of the mobsters, like you said, had moved to Tucson. You had the big crime families from New York City. The Banana family was all out in Tucson. Interestingly, Joe Banana disappeared shortly before William Branham died. I think it was shortly before. And doesn't reappear until after Branham's body was held from the grave until Easter. He doesn't reappear until after this, so that there's some weird histories there. And it developed into, you can go on the internet and type this in, just type in the Tucson bombings. You can see all of the different mob factions that were in Tucson, and they were literally blowing each other up. The FBI, there's question as to whether the FBI were planting the bombs to try to eradicate the mafia that was in Tucson. It's this weird, big mess. And the reason I mention this is, you also, for people who are familiar with the IHOP KC history, I've had numerous people, witnesses, tell me that Paul Kane was tied to the mob and that there was some weirdness going on with the financials. I'll say it like that and I'll leave it. And the reason I'm addressing this is because in the series of podcasts, we're not going there. There's clearly too much danger. When I started publishing Pat Tyler information, I actually had two different people from two different parts of the country send me a warning, one of which was an indirect warning from a man that I have watched mob movies about, telling me the ground rules of what I can and cannot say. And I'm going to say very clearly, we're not going there because we could. There's significant avenues that we could take with this research. We're not going there because I'm adhering to the ground rules that was given to me so that all people are safe.
There's some crazy stuff there to be seen. People want to look into it. So yeah, what I've mentioned so far, John, is all of the significant message churches in the United States. And it wasn't a lot. It wasn't nearly, you know, when you listen to message preachers, you get the impression, I mean, a number of the churches I even mentioned came after William Branham died so far. So it wasn't nearly this massive thing that people would lead you to believe. There were, so I will say this, so besides those churches I mentioned, there were a lot of people who were out in other churches who did believe the message. I'll use, for example, the Mosley brothers. The Mosley brothers were in James Outlaw's church. Well, James Outlaw himself didn't believe William Branham was Elijah. He was a latter rain sort of a preacher. But you had people like that in churches all over the place who did believe William Branham was the Elijah the prophet, or, you know, on down the rest of his teachings. But they were in a latter rain church where the pastors or the preachers didn't believe that themselves. Okay? And most of those people that were of that mindset were either in a Independent Assemblies of God affiliated sort of church, or they were in UPC, United Pentecostal Churches. Okay, those were the two main churches that the people holding the views that Branham was this great Elijah, that's where they were at the time that he died. And the same is true all across Canada. To the best of my knowledge, John, there was not a true message church in Canada when William Branham died, not a single one. You had out in Western Canada, you had a lot of people, maybe 200 or 300 people who believed William Branham to be this Elijah figure who were in Independent Assemblies of God churches. Ed Biskell was one of those people. He was actually an Independent Assemblies of God preacher. You know, it ended up producing Cloverdale, which I think might be the largest North American Message church today, possibly, right? He'd be right there anyway, but they weren't even in the Message really back then. They, as far as having their own church or anything, you know, he himself seems to have personally accepted it maybe the year or two before William Branham died. But across Canada, there was no true message churches. So in the West, they were primarily coming out of Independent Assemblies of God, the early people. You also had in Edmonton, John. Edmonton is like, I don't know, you know how Lee Vale explained it, those evil Canadian spirits, right? So Edmonton was like the mother of cults or something. I don't know. There's a lot of crazy stuff in Edmonton. And so there was a lot of people in Edmonton that believed the message but didn't have their own church. Actually, so my great-grandparents were Canadians. They actually were introduced to the message through people in Edmonton, right? They eventually, my grandfathers were message preachers. They started some of the original message churches in Canada. But there wasn't really a true message church back then. And so just to be clear, I mean, I have family connections into all the early message community in Canada as well. And so I feel like I can speak pretty authoritatively to what that looked like. Then in Eastern Canada, John, there were no true message churches. There probably if you think in the West, maybe as Ed Biskell as the man who's going to rise up and kind of be notable in Western Canada. Eastern Canada, there's a man named Freddie Bradford, and he's going to eventually rise up. And he had been to Branham meetings in New England, I think, in 1958, and they were all in the UPC back then. But there was about 7 UPC churches in Eastern Canada that had message believers in it that eventually would start their own churches after Branham died. And so that was, again, that is the more or less the full extent of the notable message community in the years after when William Branham died. It wasn't that big. It was maybe a few thousand people, maybe at the high end, the absolute high end, you got 5,000 people. There was mission outreach happening to Mexico. I don't know of any true message churches in Mexico at the time that William Branham died. There was mission reach happening like into Venezuela also when he died, but I don't know. There might have been a true one single message church possibly in Venezuela. It'd be right on the border becoming one. Same in Brazil. There was a message missionary in Brazil, Archie Martin, who was working back then, but he had just a small, tiny, I mean, if there were 25 message believers in Brazil, we're doing good when William Branham died. Over in Europe, there was a single message church. It was Ewald Frank's message church. He started his church, I believe, in 1964 in Krefeld. That was the only message church in all of Europe. And in Africa, John, I don't know that there was a single message church in Africa when William Branham died. You had Sidney Jackson doing mission outreach in Africa, and you also had Latter Rain missionaries working through independent assemblies of God, like in Kenya, Nigeria, Mombasa, Nairobi, that area. But I don't know that there was actually a true message church. They were mostly kind of Latter Rain, either under the Independent Assemblies of God umbrella or under the Apostolic Faith Mission umbrella in South Africa. So I don't know if there are really any true message churches when William Branham died in Africa. And then that's it. You also had, I should throw in, we had Paul Azir Lowry. There's the last one. Paul Azir Lowry claimed to have, I put this in quotes, he claimed to have about 25 churches in India in 1971. And he claimed that he started planting those churches in 1964. So there was some message group in India before William Branham died, maybe a church or two or three. And I'm not sure, we'll talk about Paul Azir Lowry down the road. I don't know how much I believe him, but he might have had 25 churches by the time he get to 1970. So
yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's any I'm missing off the top of my head. I guess I need to go back and read my book to refresh myself. But I think that is the full extent of the global message community, more or less, when William Branham died and in the years after his death.
I laughed when you said Paul Azir Lowry. It would be improper for me to use the word nut job for a person on this podcast, so I'm not going to do that. But there's a reason why I laughed. I'll just leave it at that. And that's, I'm going to have fun with this, if you can't tell, as we go through the series, because in the main sect, like I said, we knew that these were cults. And the irony is, the reason we knew wasn't so much that we could apply Dr. Stephen Hass's BITE model and understand that it was authoritarian control. We were under authoritarian control. The reason we could recognize it is because of that word that I won't use. Some of these groups were just going insane. They were literally going insane. And I know that we're going to get all kinds of feedback as we do this, because there are numerous groups that say that they were Branham churches way back during the times whenever we say there wasn't a church out there. They claim it. They're lying. There was the Branham movement, like Christian Identity, like the Klan, it was all starting to go underground when Branham died, because people realized that, yeah, Branham was kind of off his rocker, but we believe it anyway. And so they would have these little disparate groups of, I don't know what you call them. They were tape home churches. Some of them met in building. We mentioned Palmer in Macon, Georgia. Even when I was a kid, everybody gathered together in this small building that was used for the Boy Scouts. And that was the church. And we all would file in there in our suit and tie, and we'd sit in this hard folding chair, and we'd listen to a tape, a recording of a dead guy from the 1947 and 1965. That was what we called, quote unquote, church.
Oh, yeah. A lot of these churches I've mentioned, I call them churches just because, well, they had a supposed pastor, and they had a supposed general meeting place, but most of them, it was rented halls. They were using, some of them were in Masonic halls, John. Some of them were in Orangemen halls in Canada. And some of that is so odd, right, John? I mean, because these were the same halls that the Klan had used for all their stuff. So, you know, what do you make of that? It's hard to know just what to make of all that. But yeah, most of them didn't even have formal buildings. Tucson Tabernacle was just a rented hall back then. And most of these churches, they were all very, very, very small. All of them were small. I mean, there's only three churches, I think, in that whole everything I said that had more than 100 members. The Branham Tabernacle, the Prescott Leo Mercer's commune, and the Tucson Tabernacle. They were the only groups that had more than 100 members when William Branham died. All the rest of the churches were small, the 25 maybe to 75 range, most of them. And then, of course, there was that scattering of latter rain individuals just all over the place. Maybe a couple thousand potentially of those. So yeah, I think it's really interesting to know just the full scope of that. And what's important to know about those things is, as I lay all that out, I'm sure anybody listening, wherever you're from, in the back of your mind, if you know your church, you can start to maybe connect dots now. Oh, okay. I see this church here, these people here, and you can start wherever you are at in the message today, whether you are in Africa, whether you're in India, whether you're in the Philippines, whether you're in any church in the entire world that believes the message was planted or split out of one of the churches that I have mentioned in this episode today, John. That was it, and we knew them all, and at that point when William Branham died, John, we were all still one big happy family. Okay? When William Branham died, they were all still getting together. There was still single conventions. Everybody, you know, get along might be too nice of a word for it, but they all got in the same building, didn't kill each other, right? And there was hierarchy, there was trust for leadership. The message community was fairly united when William Branham died. But in our next few episodes, we'll start to talk through the things that affected the first major schism in the message and caused these people to explode. Because as we all know today, oh my goodness, there is 1,000 different sects of the message who all hate each other. So maybe we can start to talk about how that started to happen. But yeah, I would say everybody I mentioned, John, almost certainly all knew each other, right? Now, Ed Biskel and some of the later ones probably didn't know everybody, but Gordon Engman knew Lee Vail, right? And Bill Pederis knew Perry Green, right? And Earl Martin, you know, knew Fred Bradford and all that. They all knew each other, right? The early message community was small. They all was together quite a bit through those years. And they worked together to plant really what became the message as you and I know it in the years after William Branham died.
Well, I'm excited to get into this. There's so much there. And, you know, like I said at the end of the episode where we're driving around, I'll be happy if I don't mention that name again. It looks like I'm going to have to do it, unfortunately. But for me, the interesting part lies with the connections into the New Apostolic Reformation. So as you're talking through this in the series, I'm going to be trying to identify key points where people, researchers who are listening, can focus in on how the NAR developed from different theologies from each of these disparate groups. Because remember, the NAR, by and large, they used Branham as the stepping stone to create what they, this empire that they created. So they can't get rid of Branham. And what do you do with it? All of them, by and large, say, well, he went astray at the end of his life. And that's what they do because they are all aware what was created. What they're not telling you is that the reason why that this mess of groups existed when Branham died was because of the theology that they're using as the stepping stone. If Branham didn't teach that stuff that was so far off of the mark and was extra-biblical, some of it, I think I'll even go so far as to say some of it was anti-biblical. If Branham did not preach the anti-biblical things, then these groups would not have existed. And so this mess that was created, they try to push that off to the side and say, well, we believe the core William Branham that was created in latter reign, he was quote-unquote God's general, and we'll continue our ministries that are based off of that nonsense he preached. So, like I said, I'm excited to get into this. There's so many different directions we could go. So, thank you for putting all this together.
Let me throw in one other last little tidbit that popped in my head before we close out. You know, I did mention, you know, these are the 35 or so message churches before William Branham died. But there were individual message believers, I would say in the majority, half at least, of the broader Latter Rain churches. So even though there were just these few churches that eventually started to amalgamate all of these people out of the broader Latter Rain movement, there was, if you went to any average Latter Rain church, there was pretty good odds you're going to find a person in that congregation who had accepted William Branham's Elijah claim. So the people were very geographically diverse, but there were very few actual churches at the time that he died. So, all right. I'm looking forward to going through it too, John.
Well, it's going to be good. I also wanted to mention that, you know, we're going to be sharing a lot of information about churches that many of our former members have escaped, and I can already hear it now. They're going to be dying to share information about that church. So wanted to give you a platform and a voice to do so. If you contact us at william-branham.org, just go to the contact page and send us the information, and very clearly in the description, tell us that you wish to share some information for the podcast that Charles and I are doing. We will try to incorporate what we can into the podcast. And also, we may, you know, if you want to share your story in our story series, feel free to also mention in there that you wish to share your story and talk about your time in whatever particular sect you were of the cult. And that includes the Branham cult or any of the cults that were created as a result of Branhamism all the way into the NAR. So if you wish to share your story, contact us and we'll be happy to work through telling your story. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and christiangospelchurch.org. For more about the history of William Branham and the healing revivals, you can read Come Out of Her, My People. Now there's a volume 2, which is available on Amazon and Kindle. And for more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, read Weaponized Religion from Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.